Hello, and welcome to our program Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest here on Owl Radio. First, some inspiration. Poems offered me an anchor as I lost my son, so I shared them. From Josie Glossutz of The Washington Post, here's Words to Live By in Reader's Digest. In the early morning hours of March 23, 2023, about 12 hours before our treasured 12-year-old son died from a rare form of brain cancer, I climbed into his bed at Sheri Zedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, wrapped him in my arms, and recited the poem Jabberwocky. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and jimble in the wabe. My child was no longer conscious, but I hoped and believed that he could sense my presence and that my voice would comfort him and soothe his furiously beating heart. My son had learned the words to Lewis Carroll's nonsense poem by listening to me recite it to him and his twin sister at bedtime. A brave, bright, imaginative, optimistic boy, he loved the drama of the poem and the courage of the quote-unquote beamish boy as, with his quote-unquote vorpal sword in hand, he defeats his quote-unquote manxome foe. My son was also a passionate reader, but toward the end of a year punctured by surgeries, rounds of radiation, hospitalizations, and medications, it was harder for him to focus. Instead, I would sit beside his hospital bed and read aloud to him, mostly Rich Moll Crompton's Just William stories. One evening in the hospital in mid-February, I read him some of my favorite poems, poems that my mother had read to me as a child, like Cargoes by John Masefield, Quinquiraim of Nineveh from distant Ophir, Rowing Home to Haven in sunny Palestine, and a Shakespeare sonnet, When, in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, he listened, rapt and smiling. Then we talked about the meaning of the poems. A few days later, I started my own poetry group on WhatsApp, calling it Poetry is Medicine, and invited friends to join. I had found, during earlier crises, that the rhythm of poetry can soothe my anxieties. With just a word or a phrase, a poem can reach the hidden places that prayers or well-meaning advice cannot. The poems offered an anchor to me during unpredictable and painful times. In a calm interlude each day, I searched in my anthologies and on sites such as Poetry Daily for the quote-unquote right poem to share. The quote-unquote right poem could be about almost anything: an apple tree, an insect, a pie, a miracle. Some were classics: Everyone Sang by Siegfried Sassoon, A Modest Love by Sir Edward Dyer. Here's a quote from it: The lowest trees have tops, the ant her gall. One, a psalm: The Lord to me a shepherd is, want therefore shall not I. People responded with heart emojis and their own favorites. My mother shared Shakespeare's soliloquies. We had to learn chunks by heart, she wrote. My sister and I exchanged messages about the poems of R.S. Thomas, which we had studied in school, recalling one that begins, All right, I was Welsh, does it matter? Friends contributed. One sent Chinese Foot Chart by Kay Ryan. And here's how some of it goes. Look, boats of mercy, embark from our heart at the oddest knock. Another friend carefully translated the Hebrew poem, Apple of Imperfection by Varda Genisar. First speech is the speech of love. Last speech, silence. The poems took on a life of their own. Friends shared them with their friends, saying that the verses added joy to their day. The poems that you send express in words feelings that I have no ability to express, my friend Marilyn wrote. One old-school friend bought new collections, telling me, It's been years, actually decades, since I've read poetry, but you have rekindled an interest.
At 9:22 a.m. on March 23, 2023, I shared the poem Jabberwocky with my WhatsApp group. My son's heart stopped beating 3.5 hours later as I held his hand and sang to him. For our family, my husband, our daughter, his loss is a catastrophe. The space that our son had filled with his loving nature, his exuberance, his magical smile, his luminous observations, and his laughter was replaced by a gigantic empty hole. I stopped posting poems. Then my friend Layla sent me Late Fragment, Raymond Carver's last published poem. And what did you want? To call myself beloved? To feel myself beloved on the earth? It offered me some small comfort because I knew that even in my son's darkest hours, he was always loved, and still is, and was never for a moment alone. I shared Late Fragment with my poetry group, and I began again to share poems and songs. One was Taking Care by Calista Buchan. I sit with my grief. I mother it. I hold its small, hot hand. I don't say, shh. Another was Theme in Yellow. The title contains my son's favorite cheerful color, by Carl Sandburg. When dusk is fallen, children hold hands and circle round me singing ghost songs. Friends posted yellow heart emojis. They added comments, quoted favorite lines. I felt loved and supported. And I was able to get up in the morning and take care of my daughter, who has lost her twin and only sibling, from whom she has never been apart. 7 weeks before my son died, we had celebrated our daughter's bat mitzvah. In synagogue, she read beautifully from the Torah portion of Beshalach, in which the Israelites, fleeing slavery in Egypt, crossed the Red Sea on dry land, as, quote, the waters formed a wall for them on their right hand and on their left, unquote. Itself a beautiful poem, it reflected my feelings, that our community had formed strong walls around us, supporting us at every step of our grueling journey. Perhaps that's why the poem that is most meaningful to me is Moises, or Moses, by Luis Alberto de Cuenca, translated from Spanish by Gustavo Perez Firmat. On the 8th day after my son died, I read it aloud beside his grave. And here it goes. Give me your hand. We have to cross the river, and my strength fails me. Hold me as if I were an abandoned package in a wicker basket, a lump that moves and cries in the twilight. Cross the river with me, even if this time the waters don't part before us, even if this time God doesn't come to our aid and a flurry of arrows riddles our backs, even if there is no river. Next in Reader's Digest, from The Healthy, that's wellness from Reader's Digest's wellness site, thehealthy.com, here's the latest on Lyme. A vaccine is finally on the way. In the meantime, here's how to protect yourself from ticks. Debbie Waldman in Reader's Digest with the latest on Lyme. While dog owners have been able to vaccinate their pets against Lyme disease since the 1990s, the first human Lyme vaccine, Lymerix, was taken off the market by its manufacturer in 2002, after only 4 years. At the time, sales were low, partly because the market was small, about 20,000 cases a year in the United States, and partly because of unproven claims that the vaccine caused arthritis. Since then, cases have skyrocketed. Climate changes play a factor. Ticks thrive in warm, humid environments, and their habitat is expanding. They live in wooded areas, on the edges of forests, under tree canopies, and in tall grasses. Once most common in the northeastern, midwestern, and mid-Atlantic states, the tick and Lyme disease has since spread south and west. Now, almost 500,000 Americans are diagnosed and treated each year. Fortunately, new vaccines to prevent infection are underway. Moderna has 2 vaccines in development. Pfizer Incorporated and French drug maker Valneva SE have a vaccine currently in Phase 3 trials that is expected to be available in the next few years. That's great news for people like Ryan McIntyre, who began experiencing severe joint pain, unstable blood sugar levels, brain fog, and other debilitating symptoms while studying abroad in Australia in the year 2016. It got so bad that she flew home to Massachusetts early and began a frustrating quest for a diagnosis. More than one doctor attributed her symptoms to stress. After a friend asked another whether she'd been tested for Lyme disease, McIntyre requested a blood test, which confirmed she had the antibodies in her system. That result, as well as her symptoms, led her doctor to conclude that McIntyre had been living with Lyme for more than a decade, most likely since a nurse pulled a tick from her scalp after an elementary school field trip in the early 2000s near her home in Cape Cod. Lyme disease, which was first identified in Lyme, Connecticut in the 1970s, comes from the black-legged ticks that transmit the bacteria Borrelia burgdorferi. Symptoms include fatigue, fever, joint pain, headache, and chills, and they can appear anywhere from 3 to 30 days after a bite. That makes diagnosis a challenge, as does the fact that the symptoms are common for other illnesses, says Janet Sperling, an entomologist and president of ChemLine, the Canadian Lyme Disease Foundation. The one definitive symptom of Lyme disease, a bullseye-shaped rash, doesn't always show up. If left undiagnosed, Lyme disease can affect the central nervous system, resulting in a hard-to-treat chronic condition called neurologic Lyme disease. Its symptoms include brain fog, fatigue, pain, and muscle weakness. Until a vaccine is widely available, your best defense against Lyme disease is to avoid getting bitten by a black-legged tick, says Sperling. We're not going to get rid of them, she says, so we have to learn to live with them. And this sidebar, 7 smart tips to stay safe. Number 1, wear light colors, ideally long pants, socks, and closed-toed shoes. Tuck your pants into your socks and your shirt into your pants. Number 2, look for repellent clothing, such as shirts and pants treated with the insecticide permethrin. Number 3. Spray yourself with repellent that contains at least 30% DEET or 20% icaridin, also known as picaridin. Number 4. Landscape your yard to make it inhospitable for ticks. Try Tick Tubes, that's Family Handyman recommends Thermacell, the brand, which can prevent mice from picking up ticks and carrying them into your home. Number 5, check yourself for ticks, including your scalp, your groin, the backs of your knees, and behind your ears. And finally, number 7, stick to trails and avoid walking through tall grass. Let's take a time out from our heavy reading for some laughter, the best medicine. First, from LancasterFarming.com. A born and bred New Yorker is in the country when he sees a field of animals and says to the farmer, "What a strange-looking cow. Why doesn't it have horns?" "There are several reasons," the farmer replies. "Some cows get their horns late, others have their horns cut off, and some others never grow horns." "And this cow?" the city man asks. "Well, the reason this cow doesn't have any horns is because it's a horse." And from Ruth Spangler of Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, a zoo manager was sending an email requesting new animals. He wrote, "I want to order 2 mongooses," but that didn't seem right. So he rewrote it. "I would like to order 2 mongooses." That looked even weirder. Finally, he started over and wrote, "No zoo should be without a mongoose. I would like to order 2. And let's conclude this edition of Reader's Digest with the conclusion from last week's Lives in the Balance, real-life stories by a leading neurosurgeon. Dr. Christopher Honey, from the book The Tenth Nerve, writes, "Here are the stories of 2 individuals who profoundly changed my understanding of both medicine and myself and of what it means to be human. We learned last week about Jeff This week, we conclude with the story of Sayika in Reader's Digest. By 2014, I'd been a neurosurgeon for 25 years. No patient of mine had died after an effective operation, and I was proud of my winning streak. I saw my goal as operating without complication, not necessarily improving a patient's life. But a baby boy in Africa taught me to see purpose in helping the patient, yet losing to the disease. To see that medical learning and discovery is not just a science, it's also an art. In the spring of 2014, I landed in Monrovia, Liberia's capital, as part of an international aid mission that would perform the first neurosurgical operations in the West African country. The Korlebu Neuroscience Foundation was supporting this effort, a group of nurses and physicians, initially from where I worked, Vancouver General Hospital, had helped set up and equip a neurosurgery service in nearby Ghana. Now, the foundation's director wanted to put a satellite clinic in Liberia. The foundation had sent an African neurosurgeon from Nigeria to the Jackson F. Doe Hospital a month earlier to see patients and identify some for surgery. The hospital in Tapita, a six-hour drive east of the capital, had Liberia's only CT scanner. At least a dozen people were now waiting for neurosurgery if conditions were right for me to proceed. This would be their only chance for the surgery they needed. The hospital was a white, square, two-story structure with a red tile roof and a paved courtyard at its center. It was hot and humid. There was air conditioning in the operating rooms and the staff lounge, but not on the wards. At the back of the compound was a large locked shed humming with two diesel generators that provided the hospital with electricity. They ran one at a time, 12 hours each. Among the cases we would operate on were two infant boys with massively enlarged heads, characteristic of hydrocephalus. That's a condition where the flow of cerebrospinal fluid, or CSF, through the brain is blocked and the fluid builds up. CSF is a clear, water-like fluid produced within the ventricles, or the cavities of the brain, and flows around the organ, allowing it to float inside the skull. If there is a blockage en route, fluid builds up and the ventricles dilate, crushing the brain against the skull. A baby's skull is made of separate bones that, to allow the brain to grow, do not fuse for several years. The gaps between these bones, called fontanelles, feel like the soft spot on the top of any baby's head. If hydrocephalus begins before their skull is fused, the infant's head will balloon in size. Before the 1950s, the condition and its treatment were often lethal. But the two babies had very different prognoses. A CT scan of Joshua, 9 months old, showed enlarged ventricles that were pushing outwards and enlarging his skull. He would benefit from a ventricular peritoneal shunt, which regulates the flow of CFS, and I had brought one from Vancouver. He seemed otherwise healthy and happy. The second baby, Sayika, was far worse off. Also 9 months old, he could not lift his enlarged head off the crib. The brown skin of his scalp was stretched paper thin, and every vein was visible beneath its translucent surface. His young mother lived in a small village with no running water about 3 days' walk from the hospital. A nurse told me that Sayika had been treated by the local healer. When his head began to grow, the healer wrapped it in a plaster of mud, manure, and straw. The mixture turned rock hard in the sun, and the helmet limited skull growth. But the pressure inside Saika's head eventually broke the plaster. It must have been excruciatingly painful. I knew, as an outsider, that I held Western biases and should not judge, but when I heard this story and imagined the child's unnecessary suffering, I could not regard the traditional healer with equanimity. Saika's CT head scan was so abnormal that it was difficult to pick out the normal structures. Most of his brain was compressed by a grapefruit-sized cyst of fluid on the right side of the head. All of the ventricles were enlarged and pushed into the left side of the head. There was a small ribbon of abnormal brain surrounding everything, and the combination of the cyst fluid and enlarged ventricles had pushed the skull bones open, causing the massive head. He could not be saved. When we met to choose which of the boys would be operated on next, the decision was clear. Joshua. His surgery went well, and we were done by lunchtime. The follow-up CT scan showed the shunt was in an ideal location and had begun to decompress his ventricles. Joshua could go home in a few days. Our team met that evening to discuss our plans for the next day. To my surprise, the Nigerian neurosurgeon suggested we operate on Saika. I outlined why this would be futile. Saika had a serious infection, and we had no way of culturing the pathogen to choose the correct antibiotic. The infection probably came from the manure that had been wrapped around his head, the bacteria having entered through his thin scalp. We didn't have strong enough antibiotics to handle an infection from bowel bacteria. Even if we did, we couldn't provide a long enough course. A closer look at the images of his brain showed multiple smaller abscesses, and we had no way to drain them all. The infection would have already damaged his brain, and it was highly unlikely he would survive in his village. I was categorical in my conclusion. We were not going to operate on Saika. This child was going to die, and there was nothing we could do about it. My Nigerian colleague patiently explained why it was important to try. We can fail. Africans are used to medicine failing. There is no cure for Ebola, for instance, but the village needs to know we thought it was a medical problem. If we stand back, they will think we believed there was something else wrong with him. They will cast the mother out of the village. They will think the boy has been possessed and that there is some evil in his mother for her to have a child like this. Even she will believe she has done something wrong. Everyone in the room was nodding while he spoke. I was dumbstruck. I had never formulated a treatment around how society felt about a patient and his mother. They all looked at me. All I could say was, "Wow, I never thought about it like that." It did not take me long to agree that we should try to help this boy. The details of how we would do so, however, were unclear. It was medically unsound. I looked at Saika's CT scan again and eventually concocted a far-fetched but plausible plan. "We could try to drain the main fluid collection on the right side of the brain," I said. "He might get temporary relief, and we would be more certain of the diagnosis. If it is just an abscess, we will know the prognosis is lethal." Saika arrived at 9 the next morning, washed and changed by his mother and the nurse. Too weak to cry, he was laid on his back on a small table, covered in green towels. I explained the plan to everyone in the room. First, we'd put some anesthetic in his scalp. He was too weak for a general anesthetic. "Then I will push a large needle into the part of the skull where I think the abnormal fluid is," I said. "Then I'll withdraw the syringe plunger to pull out whatever fluid is there. The brain doesn't feel pain when it is touched. Saika would not suffer." I took a number of measurements off the CT and marked the spot on Saika's head where I thought we should go through his scalp. I studied the images again to understand the depth and direction of the needle and how the fluid would then distort the brain after I began to remove it. Brain shift with a needle deep inside the skull could be disastrous. When we were ready to begin, I gently washed Saika's scalp with warm water and soap. The skin looked very fragile, so I did not scrub hard. Then I applied dark brown iodine solution, and after it dried, I put a small amount of local anesthetic in, attached to a thick 2-inch long needle. I bent over the baby, resting the back of my left hand on his head and holding the syringe in both hands. "Okay, here we go," I announced, and started to advance the needle's sharp tip toward Saika's skin. That's when the lights went out, submerging us in darkness. It was early morning, but the operating room had no windows. "What the hell?" the anesthesiologist blurted. I pulled back. I had not yet pierced Saika's head. All the monitors started to beep as they switched over to battery power. The noise was deafening, particularly in the dark. 4 or 5 minutes later, the lights came back on. Shortly after, someone in dirt-stained overalls peered around the doorway of the operating room and said, "Don't worry, we just switched over the generator." The alarm on each monitor was eventually turned off, and gradually the operating room returned to normal. Saika continued to breathe, oblivious to the near disaster. I leaned over Saika again. The needle pierced his skin and penetrated deep into his brain. At the 1-inch mark, I paused and pulled back the plunger. The syringe filled with a thick green fluid. It was easy to get 50 cc. I twisted the syringe off the needle and emptied the fluid into a kidney basin. It was definitely an abscess. I reconnected the syringe and pulled out another 50 cc. Then another 50. And another. I had estimated that the volume of the cyst before surgery was at least half a liter, 500 cc. Saika's head began to collapse. The next pull of the syringe had resistance. Something was blocking the flow of pus into the needle, probably the brain collapsing into the evacuated space. I repositioned the needle further backwards and deeper, pulled out another 50 cc, and then stopped. I did not want a huge brain shift, which would tear some of the blood vessels. I put a small bandage on Saika's scalp where the needle had been. We would let the infant recover and then re-image his brain. He was swaddled and bundled off to the recovery room and was back in his mother's arms a few hours later. That evening, I went with the medical team to see how Saika was doing. His mother burst into tears of delight when she saw us. Saika was much brighter and more active since the surgery, she told me. He could cry with strength, and his cry sounded more like it did when he could lift his head. Everyone on our team was beaming, and the mood was joyous. Everyone except me was truly happy. I knew Saika would die in a few weeks. I spoke to his mother through a nurse who translated. "We are proud of how strong Saika is and how well he did during surgery," I began. "An infection made his head grow. I've removed some of the infection, but it's strong and he is very young." Her eyes pierced mine when she asked, "Can you do more?" "No," I replied. She bowed her head and turned away. She sat down in a chair beside the crib and looked at Saika and then up at me. "Thank you," came the translation. She did not cry. She picked up her son and held him, rocking him back and forth in her arms. She understood. Saika and his mother were welcomed back to the village a few days later. The nurses covered my small bandage with a very, very large dressing that wrapped around his head like a turban. It was clear to everyone that he had had a medical procedure, a brain operation. Normally, I get to see my patients after surgery and follow up and learn how they did. But Saika was a 3-day walk away. I would not hear anything further about him. Back at home, I thought about Saika a lot. His brief time in this world was painful, but he would surely die in his mother's arms, surrounded by members of his village who no longer believed he was possessed by evil spirits. Social progress was made. A life was saved. Saika's mother's life. My co-workers had made the right call. I could not put into words why I felt I was a better doctor for having met him. I only knew it was so. You have been listening to Reader's Digest on Owl Radio.
You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.